Jong-un met today with his top military officials to discuss boosting the country's defense capability. It adds to the heightened concern the North may return to a hardline stance with the United States. Kim has set a year-end deadline for the U.S. to change what he says is a policy of hostility toward Pyongyang. And he has warned he is ready to provide Washington with a Christmas gift, widely expected to be a ballistic missile test. Germany's finance minister and vice chancellor have reacted with anger to U.S. President Donald Trump's threatened sanctions, which have now forced a company laying sections of a new German-Russian natural gas pipeline to stop its work on the project. They call the U.S. action interference in Germany's internal affairs. Here's AP's Charles de Ledesma.
Trump on Friday signed the bill earlier passed by the Senate that provides for sanctions against individuals and companies involved in laying the Nord Stream 2 pipeline under the Baltic Sea from Russia to Germany. Now Switzerland-based Allseas has said in anticipation of the enactment of the National Defence Authorization Act, or NDAA, it suspended its Nord Stream 2 pipelay activities. The US has been an outspoken opponent of the pipeline, which will transport natural gas about 750 miles. Critics argue it would increase Europe's dependency on Russia for energy. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said today Moscow planned to respond to the new measures meant to block Nord Stream 2. He did not elaborate. The pipeline is designed to sharply increase the flow of natural gas from Russia to Germany. Afghanistan's Election Commission today had some welcome news for President Ashraf Ghani. He appears headed for a second five-year term in office. In preliminary results, Ghani received almost 51% of the late September vote, well ahead of a second-place finisher, Abdullah Abdullah, who won about 40% of the 1.9 million votes cast. More news at voanews.com. From Washington, this is VOA News. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi today defended a new citizenship law that critics claim discriminates against Muslims. The setting was a ruling Nationalist Party rally in New Delhi. This follows days of violent protests against the legislation. Modi called for Indians to respect their parliament. President Trump says the United States and China will very shortly sign their so-called Phase One trade agreement. Announced earlier this month, the deal is part of a bid to end the long-running trade war between the world's two largest economies. Under the accord, the United States would reduce some tariffs in exchange for a large increase in Chinese purchases of American farm products. The president also used a Florida speech to attack Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for not yet sending the articles of impeachment against him to the Republican-held U.S. Senate for a trial.
So now she says, you know, she has no case. She has no case. So let's not submit it. That's good, right? That's good. But you know what? So unfair. It's so unfair. She has no case. Did they look bad? They got up the same thing, the Constitution. They are violating the Constitution.
Britain's main opposition Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn today apologized for waging an election campaign that handed Prime Minister Boris Johnson a mandate to take the UK out of the European Union next month. But the veteran socialist politician defended his far-left platform and blamed the media for helping relegate his century-old party to its worst performance since before World War II. Corbyn said, quote, "I wanted to unite the country that I love, but I'm sorry that we came up short, and I take my responsibility for it." A senior UN official reports more than a million Palestinians are living in crisis conditions in Israeli-occupied territories. He's pushing a $348 million plan to address Palestinians' critical humanitarian needs. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN's recently launched 2020 Humanitarian Response Plan aims to assist 1.5 million of the 2.4 million Palestinians in the occupied territories. Most are residents of Gaza, who are in particularly dire straits. The Humanitarian Coordinator for Occupied Palestinian Territory, Jamie McGoldrick, says nearly half of Gaza's population is unemployed. That figure includes 7 out of 10 young people under age 30 who have no jobs. Among them, he says, are more than 400,000 university graduates who cannot find work.
That was Lisa Schlein reporting for VOA from Geneva. Voters in Croatia are going to the polls today for a presidential election. The incumbent conservative Kolinda Grabar-Kitarovic is being challenged by the leftist former prime minister Zoran Milanovic and right-wing singer Miroslav Skoro. More news at voanews.com. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Fearing to hold even internal party elections out of fear of losing, then you wonder that we thought, you know, would they try to do something that may affect the general elections? And lo and behold, where are we today? For the first time ever, we see so many petitions before our court about election rigging. Never before has that happened.
Former Botswana President Serete Kama, Ian Kama, expresses concern about what he says is the country's democracy decline.
We don't agree that there is anything in the Constitution that outlaws or that outrightly bans the existence of political parties.
A major Eswatini trade union group condemns the arrest of pro-democracy activists.
Permit me to particularly point out the special status which the Northwest and the Southwest regions will henceforth be entitled to. It is therefore high time to silence the guns. It is therefore high time to stop the killings, violence, and destructions.
And some Cameroonian lawmakers say moves to grant special status to English-speaking regions will not solve the ongoing separatist crisis. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Former president of Botswana is expressing concern about the prevailing democratic conditions in the country. Serete Kama, Ian Kama, says there is a decline in the rate of democracy following the disputed October elections. Displeased with the outcome of the polls, opposition groups questioned the results, citing overt irregularities while vowing to legally mount a challenge. In the second part of my interview with the former president, Mr. Kama denies reports that plans to control President Mokgweetsi Masisi from behind the scenes led to the fallout. Mr. President, some are suggesting that because you wanted to control the president and because you chose him as a vice president, you felt empowered that he would become, so to speak, the puppet master to pull the strings. And because he resisted, he became his own man. That is why you appear to be bitter. What is your response to that?
Now, my response to that, we've seen that in other countries. And I was one of the first people when I was in office to say, you see, that's exactly what shouldn't happen. When people who have been in power can't let go. It's like on this continent where we've had certain presidents come into office with a constitution that provides for two terms. And as soon as they see that two terms is going pretty fast and they want to stay in power purely out of self-interest, they then decide to amend the constitution to have a third term so that they can continue. Others have done exactly what you've just described now, where they think they would be able to continue to control their successors and try to do that. Let me tell you, I did not want to go into politics. I was asked to leave the army to come into politics. Politics was never on my radar. So when I finished with politics, I wanted to be literally finished with it. And I didn't want to have anything to do with the leadership. It was now in someone else's hands. That's why I went to that extent to go around the country and introduce him to the people of Botswana, that this is now going to be your successor. I never asked to be involved in any shape, manner or form in the government going forward.
But Mr. President, we also heard reports that you wanted some perks that you enjoyed while president to be enjoying even when you had finished your term, and that one of your aides that you had wanted to become your aide or assistant after you finish your term was embroiled in some controversy. These, they said, you are particularly unhappy about, and that is why you are so displeased with the current administration and will use every means, including campaigning for the opposition, just to undermine the administration in Habaroni.
You know, these allegations, as you've been referring to them one by one, are exactly the things that they have been putting out. I don't know who you've been talking to, but I certainly get the impression You've been talking to people from that side, because this is the kind of thing I've had to put up with for the last 1.5 years, those kind of allegations. And at every instance, they've been trying to frustrate me in whatever I want to do, whether it's my conservation work, whether it's my charitable work, in the Constitution as a benefit. I'm allowed to have a private secretary, which is probably the person you're talking about. And I put up a name, because this is a private secretary that I'm going to have to work with, someone who had retired from the government, so they didn't need him. But just because it's someone that I worked with previously, and out of an attempt to frustrate me, they denied me that person. I then gave them, because you said this is somebody, who had some challenges or controversies around him. So I chose a second person, and I said, okay, I'll take this person. That person as well, they wouldn't appoint. So I'm still left with the same junior official that I had right from the start, and they've made no attempt, even when I invited them to say, okay, you suggest names. In fact, they even suggested that they could give me a range of names to choose from. They've never done that.
So, Mr. President, if I may ask you, what would you say is the current status of your charity work to help the people of Botswana?
Well, I'm just proceeding with it, despite their attempts to try to block it. And you wouldn't know why, because charitable work is purely that, charitable work. And because it would mean that I go to different parts of the country, I meet communities to go and help them. That was something which they wanted to prevent, because he just didn't want me to make any public appearances. So they've been trying to frustrate me at every attempt, from being able, telling government officials not to facilitate, trying to block, use the intelligence services to go to where I would be going in advance of me and warn those people not to attend such charitable events. I mean, this is something you just would not ever expect could happen in a country like Botswana. It's the kind of thing we've read about happening in Sudan under Bashir, under Idi Amin, under Mugabe in Zimbabwe. Those kind of things, not in Botswana.
Botswana is always cited as a democratic beacon across Africa. How would you rate the state of democracy in Botswana at the moment?
I would say it's definitely in decline. If you've also been following how our elections went, you would see there are a number of petitions before the courts about allegations of rigging of the elections. Something certainly went wrong there that we've never, ever seen before. And even in their own party, in the ruling party, they were supposed to have held 3 elections this year, and they postponed them out of fear that they would lose their position. So it's very worrying, and that's never happened before. Because I was in this ruling party, I led it for 10 years. I know how things are supposed to be. So when they go to the extent of fearing to hold even internal party elections after fear of losing, then you wonder that we thought, would they try to do something that may affect the general elections? And lo and behold, where are we today? For the first time ever, we see so many petitions before our courts about election rigging. Never before has that happened.
Seretse Kama Ian Kama is a former Botswana president. He spoke with me from the capital, Habaroni. The Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, or TUKOSWA, says it appears the government is using state institutions, including the police, to intimidate and harass pro-democracy activists. Secretary General Induduzi Jina says the actions of the police to detain and question pro-democracy activists are aimed to stifle any demands for democratic reforms. This after the police said they were investigating issues of state security. TUKOSWA Secretary General Induduzi Jina tells me the police should not be involved in politics, which he says undermines their independence and public trust in the institution mandated to enforce law and order.
Our position is that it becomes then an unfair or a draconian tendency to then target leaders of political parties. Our view is that, in fact, police should desist from entering the political arena. They should stay away from politics. We are saying this because of the questions that we are informed they were posed. It is like the police were interested on the nature of the demands of the political parties, which should not be the interest of the police. Therefore, the police should be interested on anything that is happening that is of criminality. It then cannot be a criminal offense. Clear, they were being questioned for political motives, and the police should clearly stay away from interfering with the core in terms of the politics.
But Ndudusi, the constitution that you mentioned mandates the police to maintain law and order and to enforce the law. The police are saying that is exactly what they are doing. So why fault them?
That is the role of the police everywhere in the world. But that does not then give the police rights to intimidate and interfere on the scopes of operations of life where they should not be interfering. In fact, there was no disorder in our view, not unless we would be told something as different. We are not aware. Otherwise, we are not even aware what is it exactly that they wanted. Safe to say that whatever then that they wanted was politically motivated, which is wrong then to target individuals because of their political affiliation. With us, there was only one trade union leader that was intended to be targeted. And unfortunately, that is an embarrassment as well, to say they then raided a homestead where the comrades left a year ago. So they then decided that in fact it was academic to continue to raid. Maybe they are still coming for some of them, the trade union leaders, we are not sure.
But the police came out saying that they invited these pro-democracy activists concerning state security. Don't you think they have a legitimate right to do so as mandated by the Constitution?
No. That is intimidation. It can't be just general for everyone. It can't be that you have done one and the same prima facie evidence for you to be taken into a police station. But I would just make an example with the president of the Nguana National Liberatory Congress. Apparently, they were breaking through their way to get hold of her. And clearly, if you can get to an extent that you take a decision to break a door of one's house, then you should be having overwhelming evidence that you are going to arrest that person. Not to question him or her for some few hours, then release her after you have broken down and you have destroyed his property.
Others are also saying that political parties are banned in the kingdom of Eswatini. What is the stance of Tukoswa?
Our position is yes, we agree that state institutions are used to intimidate voices of dissent. Two, we don't agree that there is anything in the Constitution that outlaws or that outrightly ban the existence of political parties. Because the starting point is the existence of an organ, then the rights. Our position is that political parties have been denied their right to contest for political power. But the Constitution allow their existence.
Ndudusi Gina is the Secretary General for the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, or Tukoswa. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabane. The leader of the Banned Sudanese Journalists Union says the group seeks a dialogue with the transitional government to rescind the decision and lift the ban. Sadiq Al-Rizaiki says the decision to ban the Journalists Union is unfortunate and regrettable. Last week, the administration in Khartoum dissolved the Sudanese Journalists Union. It came after officials said the government dissolved the group in accordance with new measures aimed to disband organizations controlled by former President Omar Hassan al-Bashir's government. For more reaction regarding the dissolution of the Journalists Union, I reached Sadiq al-Rezaki in Khartoum.
The government does not give us any reasons, but they said this union is belong to the time of Bashir, is part of system of Bashir. And we try to to inform them that we are an independent union, and we are all the union is elected by the General Assembly in the union, the Congress of our union. We are not part of the government of al-Bashir, but this is a political issue for the government. It's not quite reasons, it is a political issue.
But there are some concerns by some Sudanese that indeed your union was used by the former administration officials, and that is why it was necessary for your group to also be banned, just like the former Sudanese ruling party was banned. How do you respond to that?
That is not right, because we are an independent union. We are a member in IFJ, International Federation of Journalists, and I am president of Federation of African Journalists, and I am vice president in Arab Journalists Union. All the union in Sudan, there is elections, and it is an independent union. No use from the former system or former government of our unions. We are independent. And the member of executive committee of our union is a different direction and different ideas and different parties. Most of them is not in the former party of the former government. We are independent, we are journalists. This is not, they want to involve politics in our jobs, in our business. We are not a politician. We are only journalists.
So what are you going to do? Because I understand that your group wants to go to court to restrain the government or the administration from imposing the ban as it stands at the moment. What is your next line of action?
We have many actions. Yesterday we are stopped in front of our union, all the executive committee and the council of the union and some of the journalists in Sudan against this action from the government. And now we are going to the court. And we are in contact with all the international organizations for protecting journalists and IFJ and all the unions in all around the world. They are support us. Many of organizations support us. And we try to resolve this this problem. And now we are doing our best to talk with the government about these issues.
Sadiq Arezaki is the leader of the Banned Sudanese Journalists Union. He spoke with me from Khartoum. English-speaking lawmakers in Cameroon say legislation approved by the country's parliament to grant two English-speaking regions special status will not solve the ongoing separatist crisis in the northwest and southwest regions. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kizaka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Aboubakary Abdoulaye, the French-speaking senior vice president of Cameroon's Senate, the legislature's upper house, who presided over Friday's closing plenary session of the extraordinary session of parliament, said approval of the bill should end the violence over the issue.
Permit me to particularly point out the special status which the northwest and the southwest regions will henceforth be entitled to. It is therefore high time to silence the guns. It is therefore high time to stop the killings, violence, and destructions.
The extraordinary session of the upper and lower houses of parliament were convened a week ago following instructions from Cameroon's President Paul Biya. Biya's bill was voted on by both houses and would create assemblies of chiefs, regional assemblies and regional councils for the two English-speaking regions, with each of them having elected presidents, vice presidents, secretaries, Public Affairs Management Controllers and three commissioners responsible for what the bill describes as economic, health, social, educational, sports and cultural development affairs. It would also delegate more powers to elected mayors and give them the authority to recruit hospital staff and teachers. Kavai Yege Jibril, Speaker of the National Assembly, the lower house of parliament, says the new law reflects the views of a majority of those consulted by BIA and Prime Minister Joseph John Gute prior to the extraordinary sessions.
Let's remark if we have consolidated l'unité et l'intégration nationale.
He says the special status for the English-speaking North, West and South West regions will consolidate national unity and integration and the will of Cameroonians to live together as an indivisible people. He says the law will boost economic and cultural integration. French-speaking lawmakers, who constitute more than 80% of the 180-member lower house and 85% of the upper house, largely voted the bill into law. The opposition Social Democratic Front, which has 13 English speakers out of its 19 members in the lower house and 7 English speakers from the Northwest region in the upper house, refused to back the bill, with some refusing to vote and others voting against it. SDF spokesperson Dennis Kemlemo described the special status by phone to VOA as an insult to English-speaking Cameroonians who want more autonomy in the majority French-speaking country.
They have deliberative powers and not legislative powers, which means that they cannot make laws. This is terrible. Another very vexing clause in that special status is that there is no financial autonomy. What goes to the Southwest and Northwest, the special status region, it depends on the political whims and caprices of the president and the government in place at the moment.
Kemlemo said most English speakers expect the creation of a federal state recognizing their cultural and linguistic identity. He said the French-speaking regions should constitute one state while the English speakers form another in the Federal Republic. Kemlemo said the bill a majority of the English-speaking lawmakers refused to vote for or voted against cannot solve the crisis in the English-speaking regions. The special status for the English-speaking regions was proposed during the so-called Grand National Dialogue called by BIA last September 30 to October 4 to propose solutions to the crisis in the English-speaking regions. Separatist leaders invited to the national dialogue refused to take part, calling it a non-event. On social media, they have called the special status a non-event, indicating that they want nothing but total independence for the English-speaking regions. Violence erupted in 2017 in Cameroon's English-speaking regions when teachers and lawyers protested alleged discrimination at the hands of the French-speaking majority. The crisis has killed at least 3,000 people and displaced over 500,000, according to the United Nations. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free, pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination. Thank you.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. But first, some Cameroonians say a genuine dialogue without preconditions are the best way to resolve the ongoing crisis in parts of the English-speaking areas in Cameroon. This, despite the recent Grand National Dialogue with proposed recommendations aimed to resolve the crisis. For analysis, Professor Elvis Ngole Ngole, a prominent member of the governing party, the Cameroonian People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM, joins me live in the studios. Prof, how are you, and welcome to Nightline Africa.
Thank you very much, Peter, and it's a great pleasure to be on your prestigious program, Nightline Africa, and I seize this opportunity to extend my regards and my best wishes to your audience, your radio audience, on the occasion of the Christmas and the upcoming New Year.
Thank you very much. So, Prof, people are saying that in spite of the special status as recommended by the Grand National Dialogue organized by the government, you are a keen follower, a prominent member of the ruling party. You've heard reports that some people are saying this special status is not enough to resolve the crisis. What is your take on that?
You know, my take on the issue of special status is that those who think of the grant of special status as something which is not worth or has no value or that is nothing, I think they are wrong, and it's a misinterpretation of what the special status is all about. Look. My take is that I was a participant at the Major National Dialogue, and I was honored to be a participant, a delegate. And from what I know, of the more than 600 or so delegates or participants at the Major National Dialogue, more than 75% were from the Northwest and Southwest regions, precisely because the government, under the leadership of President Biya, wanted that the discussions and the exchanges should be mostly carried out by delegates from the two English-speaking regions, so that whatever proposals or recommendations they will make would be recommendations that are legitimate and that come from the people who are feeling the pain or who are undergoing the crisis.
I'm not cutting you short, Prof, but Akeremuna, a prominent lawyer, a human rights defender, is saying that although he was invited to participate, he was not allowed to speak. He didn't question anything, and that there were no preconditions. So the dialogue seemed fixed. The outcome was already fixed, and that nothing came out that will resolve the crisis. What is your reaction to that?
No, I mean, I have all the respect for Barrister Akeremuna, whom I know personally very well, and I think that interpretation of his is a wrong one, because from what I know, it was free, the dialogue was free, and people, the participants, expressed themselves freely. The participants expressed themselves without taking into consideration even the points, the 8 points or the commissions that were constituted within the framework of the dialogue, the Major National Dialogue. Participants spoke freely, and they made recommendations and proposals and in all freedom and in all conscience, and no one has been tortured or imprisoned or has been unduly treated simply because of the views they held. So people were free, and the recommendations that were made, including the recommendation of granting a special status, was, as you know, in all dialogue, a sort of a meeting point of all the issues that were discussed. You know, in the Major National Dialogue, some participants came in to propose that Cameroon should be a federation. Others came in to propose that Cameroon should implement the constitutional disposition of decentralization, which you could call devolution. And perhaps others even came in to say that that they wanted independence, for example, for the two English-speaking regions.
Talking about the independence, yeah. Some suggest that in spite of the Grand National Dialogue, the separatists, whom the government has often described as terrorists, were not invited to be part of the discussion since they are part of the problem. Yeah. They have to be part, they said, of the solution in order to resolve the crisis and maintain Cameroon's territorial integrity in spite of their demand for a separate country to be called Ambazonia. How do you respond to that?
Let us state the facts as they are, because it's good that our audience understands that we are being pedagogic. Fact number one, everyone was invited, including the separatists. And some separatists did take part. Some separatists came in and took part, and none of them was in prison. Or they took part and expressed themselves freely. Other separatists who were invited refused to participate. That is a matter of record. But for me, those who took part, the separatists who took part, we have to give them credit that they are people who are willing, in all good conscience, in all freedom, to move forward and to find common ground and find a solution. And I think everyone appreciates those who did that. But for those separatists who refused to take part and to accept the invitation, I think they have themselves to blame. They were not excluded. They excluded themselves. But nevertheless, the fact that they excluded themselves did not stop those who were willing to participate to carry out the discussions and to make the proposals and to end up with the grant of a special status as a way to move forward. You see, people tend to think that when you are in a Republican setting, particularly within the framework of democracy, you can't have it all. You cannot simply because you want something and that you must get everything that you want. What is the bottom line is that when you want something, you must understand that you are not alone and that everyone tries to come up with an idea that will eventually come to a meeting point where we will find a way forward. And the way forward is that between those who wanted a federation and those who wanted that decentralization should be implemented, they arrived at a consensus. The consensus was the recommendation on a special status. And a special status, for those who think negative about it, a special status means really what? It is a positive consensus on the part of willing Cameroonians, both of the English-speaking and the French-speaking parts, to move forward and to find a solution to the problems plaguing and to the conflict that is in the northern and southern. It's good to know what it is.
Excellent point. But my point is, what is the next steps for it? Because people in the lawmaking bodies are even questioning the status of what you just talked about, the special status to be granted to the Anglophone regions. What is the next step forward to immediately address the conflict, to give the people who have been caught in the crossfire of these two opposing groups, to get them some respite and restore peace?
Indeed, and that is what the special status is all about. The special status signifies, one, the recognition by the government and by the state of Cameroon that the English-speaking regions, the two English-speaking regions out of the 10 regions, are different in culture, in history, from the other 8 regions. That is recognition. The second significance of the special status is that the grant of special status recognizes that the two English-speaking regions of the northern and southwest regions have had problems, and that these problems have to be addressed by the government and the state of Cameroon. And thirdly, the special status, granting of a special status is a recognition that the government of the Republic is willing and is determined to solve the problems plaguing the northwest and southwest regions. So you can see that it is a positive, it's expression of a positive will to move forward. And in terms of content, if you look at the content, as your reporter, Mr. Kinzekam, Edwin Moki, has just stated, the content of the special status is such that
it gives set greater autonomy to the people of the peoples of the Northwest and Southwest regions, the two English-speaking regions, to be able to have certain institutions, and for these institutions to work in a way as to enable them to feel more autonomous, more responsible, and to be able to achieve certain desires and certain goals as they would want. This is something which has never happened before, and we should be able to give credit where credit is due, that the special status gives the peoples of the Northwest and Southwest greater autonomy, greater advantages, greater freedom, and because it gives them these advantages, there is no reason
for them to be treated as second-class citizens, as they originally said. But, Prof, we'll continue this discussion another time. Professor Elvis Ngolengole is the coordinator of academia for the ruling Cameroonian People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM. He joined me live here in the VOA studios right here in Washington, D.C. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. Liverpool, one of football's most historical and successful clubs, have finally no more worlds left to conquer. The European champions Liverpool capped off a successful football year in dramatic style by lifting their first FIFA Club World Cup trophy with a 1-0 victory in extra time against Brazilian side Flamengo in Qatar's capital, Doha. Neither club was able to break through the opponent's defenses in a fast-paced first half of Saturday's final that saw contrasting styles of football inside the packed Khalifa International Stadium. After Liverpool won the FIFA Club World Cup Qatar 2019 title, the FIFA Technical Study Group chose Mohamed Salah as the player of the tournament. Liverpool's Mohamed Salah won the Adidas Golden Ball and Alibaba Cloud Player of the Tournament Award. The Adidas Silver Ball went to Flamengo's Bruno Henrique, and the Adidas Bronze Ball went to Al Hilal's Carlos Eduardo. Africa's representatives, Esperance Sportive de Tunis, won the FIFA Fair Play Award. Still in football, Nigeria have lost their bid to become the first African country to host a global women's tournament after FIFA chose Costa Rica and Panama as joint hosts for next year's Under-20 World Cup. Nigeria's bid would have seen games staged in Lagos, Benin City, Asaba, and Uyo, but FIFA said it has opted for the first jointly hosted tournament in Costa Rica and Panama after an inspection visit to both CONCACAF nations as well as further discussions with the two relevant member associations. Nigeria previously hosted the men's Under-20 World Cup in 1999 and the Under-17 version 10 years later. Nigeria are one of four countries, alongside USA, Germany and Brazil, to have participated in every World Under-20 tournament since its inception 17 years ago. The Falconets reached the final in 2010 and 2014, but lost to women's football superpowers Germany on both occasions. And host Uganda won the 2019 CECAFA Senior Challenge Cup on Thursday, beating Eritrea 3-0 in the final of the East African Regional Championship. Anukani Bright put the Cranes ahead after 31 minutes, with Mustafa Kiza and Joel Madondo scoring in the second half to clinch the title. It's a record 15th CECAFA championship for Uganda. Runners-up Eritrea had impressed many people by reaching the final. The underdogs booked their place by beating Kenya's Harambee Stars 4-1 in their semi-final in Jinja on Tuesday. Kenya took the bronze medal with a 2-1 victory over Tanzania in their third-place playoff match. Three African nations are among the top 10 points winners on FIFA's world rankings for 2019. Africa Cup of Nations winners Algeria gained 135 points during the year, just three behind Asian Cup champions Qatar, who earned the most over the last 12 months. Despite the gains, Algeria are only the fourth-ranked team in Africa and 35th globally. Nigeria are seventh on the list and Madagascar 10th globally when it comes to points won in 2019. The Super Eagles, who won the bronze medal at the Nations Cup, are third on the continent, and 31st globally. Madagascar end the year at number 21 in Africa and 91st overall following their quarter-final appearance at the Nations Cup in Egypt. Nations Cup runners-up Senegal remained the top-ranked side in Africa ahead of Tunisia in second spot. Respectively, the duo are 20th and 27th globally. Belgium are the FIFA's team of the year for the second successive time, ahead of France, with Brazil third. Finally, Kenya's great Eliud Kipchoge will return to racing for the first time since his historical sub-2-hour marathon in April's London Marathon. The 35-year-old Kipchoge will be bidding to become the first athlete to win the elite men's race 5 times on April 26th. The world record holder has won on all 4 of his previous visits to London, setting a course record this year. His groundbreaking time of 1 hour, 59 minutes and 40 seconds in Austria in October was the first time a human had covered the marathon distance in less than 2 hours. However, it's not classed as a world record because various aspects of the specially designed challenge, such as rotating pacemakers and bike-delivered drinks, ruled his time ineligible. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing from Jody with Sugar Coconut, and then Fuse ODG featuring Sean Paul with Dangerous Love. And then Diana Nyange finishes up with Ange Jua.
Time.
Blues, ODG, and SPZ, what we tell them. Blaze them! Look at you, in that dress. Girl, you dangerous like a gun. Give them you, nothing less. Girl, you murder everyone. Your love is a killer. Your love is a killer. Hey, look at you, in that dress. Girl, you dangerous like a gun. Give them you, nothing less. Girl, you murder everyone. Your love is a killer. Your love is a killer. Cause the way that she looking is so cool. If you ain't ready, then you need to go home. Maybe where I guess you had running on a solo. She got me begging hold up. And she all up on me like a logo. But I'm not complaining. My baby, let's go, go, go. She killin' with the dance, she better with the waist. Everybody watch her when she turn up in the place. You ain't got a chance if you really tryna race. She already had a finish line with her pace. I shot it went down, then she went low. Gave it to her battle like she in a relay. The craziest thing is she don't know how beautiful she is every day.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Perhaps as a sort of Christmas present, President Salva Kiir and his rival and Vice President Riek Machar met in Juba and announced that they had reached agreement on a power-sharing and unity government that will take effect at the end of 100 days in February next year. They added that they had not been able to reach an agreement on the crucial question on the number of states, but they were waiting for the arrival of the Vice President of South Africa, who has been handling this matter. Later, Mr. Riek Machar gave some surprising news when he announced within a week or two the two rival armies will meet to begin the process of unification. It is the tense of the situation that made this news skeptically received, both by the people of South Sudan and most of the international community. There is a feeling that the two leaders might be concerned that the international community and donors might soon give up on them because they have not been serious in reaching an agreement, and that the announcement was just to give an impression of progress where there is none. There is also the possibility that both President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar could see what is happening around them. They are separated from the Sudan because they believe that governance in the Sudan has broken, and that they believe they, as a separate sovereign state, will provide better governance to the people of South Sudan. But what are they saying? After a tumultuous few months and years, the people of the Sudan have been making rapid progress in reconciliation and efforts to reach among themselves on some crucial issues. They have even met in Juba to have some solution between the transition government in the Sudan and rebels in the Sudan. This may also have been a motivating factor. But there is also concern at the silence of IGAD and SADC on this announced progress. If there is such a major advance, why are they so silent? The question then is, what can we expect from the two leaders, Riek Machar and President Salva Kiir? And when the fog of events have lifted, what do we expect to see? Are we going to see the harbinger of a joyous and prosperous year for the people of South Sudan? Or is this just a mirage? But what will happen is that the people of South Sudan will witness to their detriment meaningless infighting between those in the political and military class. This is the question we are all waiting to see in the new year. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, reporter Douglas Impoga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nelson Lopez, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, he who is free of faults will never die. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. Boeing's unmanned Starliner crew capsule has been